Okay, so good morning, everybody. So it's a good thing for me to start this sequence of presentations because this will allow plenty of room for improvement and getting better all day long for all my fellow program committee members. The work I'm going to talk about today is joint work with my PhD student, Andrzej Wasilkowski. And it was originally announced as Mining Temporal Properties. And since we now came up with a new name for it, it's now called Mining Operational Precondition. I'd like to motivate this with a well-known program, SPECJ, language SPECJ, compiler SPECJ. If you want what I think about SPECJ or SPEC-oriented programming in general, feel free to invite me for a beer. And after two or three beers, my tongue will come loose. Today, I will just present you one single little aspect-oriented program. This is bug.aj, and the title of this, the file name of this very program already suggests that there is something wrong with it. Actually, there's nothing wrong with this program as it stands. It does nothing useful. But if you take this very program and feed it into the SPECJ compiler, here's the program again, you invoke the SPECJ compiler to compile this program into an executable form, and what you get is an error message. This is actually a pretty long error message. I was pretty amazed. I was using error messages like, say, semicolon missing or something like that. But this is a true error message. This is what you're supposed to work with right now. And the interesting thing in here is this exception thrown from SPECJ, which means that the compiler simply has crashed and has crashed for good, and you are not supposed to file this as a bug and see in the bug repository for SPECJ whether the bug actually has been fixed. So another interesting information in here is this information. Bugs for exception thrown have titles file line from the top stack. That is, you can actually look up where this exception was being thrown. And it turns out that there's a very specific place in the file where the exception is being thrown, which is this B-cell class weaver.java in line 1016. And if you look at this very file and line, what you find is a very specific function, which is called weave at field repeatedly. This method has a bug. It can actually be seen by the naked eye. Yes, where is it? Who's with the expert? Yes?
Iter2 has next,
exactly. Iter has next in here, and this actually should be Iter2. You set the record.
I've made this mistake so many times.
Maybe we should look at some. It's a piece of code review. I tried this with graduate students from different schools. So far, let me see, which one was the best so far?
I think in the Technical University of Darmstadt, the group of Mira Mersini, there was one who popped up after 20, who raised his hands after 20 seconds,
but you set the record so far. Very good. Okay, so this is the error in here. So there's two iterators, but the second iterator doesn't check for its own hasNext method, but rather checks for the hasNext method of the outer iterator, and this is what causes the exception being raised here, because this simply iterates on and on, even though there is no next element available. So what we're having here is a common error. Yes, what we're having here is an invalid usage of an iterator, because normally before calling next, you should check whether there actually is a has next element, whether there is next element, which you normally do using hasNext. Now this property that there should be a next element is something we usually call a precondition for a method. That is, if there is no next element, we violate the precondition that there should be a next element. And
This is a very, very old and very, very well-established principle of computer science, of course, that we do have, that every single method has a precondition that needs to be fulfilled in order to be able to call this very, very function. Traditional preconditions are axiomatic, that is, they describe the state of a system. And this is all fine. However, a traditional precondition does not tell us how to reach that specific state. Let me illustrate this using an example from another programming language. This is C. This is the call to close. This is traditional Unix POSIX style. You close a file and give it a file descriptor. In order to be able to invoke close, you cannot pass an arbitrary integer in here, but the integer you use in here must be a valid file descriptor. This is a traditional axiomatic precondition for calling close, otherwise close will fail. What I want to come up with, though, is a description of how to come up with a valid file descriptor. And in our case, this file descriptor, in case of Unix systems, POSIX system, the file descriptor must eventually come from a call to the open system call. Open returns a new file descriptor. Well, there's also dup and dup2 for Unix professionals. Let's keep this simple for a moment. You need to have a call to open which returns this file descriptor, and then typically you also have calls to read and to write, because normally you open a file for a specific purpose and not simply to close it right afterward. The challenge I'm looking at is, how can we check that, say, a file descriptor in here actually stems from a call to open? This is something we can check using static analysis, but it's also something in order to be able to check it, it's also something we need to specify first. If we go and specify that, we could go for and specify, for instance, that for close the file descriptor must come from open, there must be these read and write calls in between. This is something we can come up with a language that does that, or with some sort of type state mechanism, for instance. But the problem we're facing here with existing software is that if we want to add such specifications on where specific values come from normally, we're having a huge, huge load of specification to be done. It's very much like, say, suppose you have a program in an untyped language and want to add static types to all, and want to attach static types to all the arguments there are. This is also a tremendous task. So what we want to do is, instead, we want to set up a system that learns from existing usage of such methods in order to learn where the individual arguments typically come from, these very operational preconditions, and that's able to learn these preconditions, and also that's able to find out where such operational preconditions are being violated. This is a tool we call OPMiner. There's a certain tradition these days in calling tools two letters and then minor. This is OPMiner for operational preconditions. This is the way it works. You take a program, Java program. What OPMiner does is it extracts usage models which describe the data flow through the individual methods, data and control flow through the individual methods. From these models, we extract temporal properties telling which methods precede each other. We extract patterns in there, which is frequently occurring temporal properties. And then we find out where these individual properties would be violated. So let me show how these most important steps work in here. How do we extract such usage models? And what is a usage model anyway? Here's a simple piece of code. This is a piece of code which builds a stack and pushes random numbers on this very step, followed by -1. And what we do in here, we extract a control flow graph, which means that
we do have a graph with where each node stands for a specific place in the program for a specific program counter, and the transitions are annotated with appropriate statements. So this is first basic block, second basic block. Here we have a branch. Control flow can either go through the body or we can go outside. This is straightforward compiler technology. And once we extract such a model for every single method there is. Once we have such a model, we go and we narrow it down to the usage of specific objects in here. This now is a model which just drives the entire piece of code. But when we narrow it down, say, to the usage of only the stack, we simply retain all the transitions there are that relate to the stack. Every other transition becomes an anti-transition. And this is the model we get in here. This is how the stack is being used in this very method. It's initialized, we're pushing elements on the stack, and we're having a final push, and this is how the stack is being used. Likewise, we can use it, say, for the way the random object is being used in here. Again, we look at all the transitions that involve random objects. Again, we have a number of empty transitions which we can remove. And then we see this is how the random object is being used in here. It's initialized. There's an object being called, and then we call random again and again. Here's a couple of this one was a crafted example. Here's a couple of real object usage models. For instance, this is how the add method in jpanel is being used. You initialize the panel and then you add stuff to it. Or you initialize the panel, you set the layout of the panel, and then you add stuff to it. These are the two ways panels are commonly being used. Here's a method from our AspectJ, reproperties. You probably don't know what reproperties is, but you can see how it's being used in this very model. There's a list that's being initialized. And then it's being filled with the method createPropertyList. Then there's properties being added to this very list. And then finally, this list is being passed as an argument to this method readPropertyList. This is the way the list that's being passed here as an argument is being constructed via these very three methods that are always used before readPropertyList is being called. And here's one, resource get flags. Before calling get flags on the method, you typically first invoke get resource info. So this is how we extract these individual models. From these models, we can extract how individual methods proceed, proceed each other. Now let me show you how we can find anomalies in here. The idea is to find places that are different from normal usage, and normal usage is simply the majority of all usages. If there's a large number of a specific method is being, a specific argument is being used in one way, and a small number where it's used another way, this large number becomes the normal usage, and the small number becomes the abnormal usage. All right, let me illustrate this in a small example. We have a number of such template properties: start precedes stop, lock precedes unlock, UF precedes close. And we have a number of methods, say get, in which these template properties occur, which is indicated by a square in here, or they don't occur, meaning no square. Now, there's a number of methods, and each of these methods implements a specific set of properties. And what we are now looking for in this diagram is rectangles. Large rectangles that are as wide as possible and particularly as high as possible, because this constitutes a pattern, meaning that these properties always occur together in a large number of methods. The larger such a pattern, the more important it is. And the way we find these patterns is by formal concept analysis. If any one of you ever worked with formal concept analysis, this rectangle and finding a large rectangle is actually a formal concept. The more methods there are, the higher the support, and this is what we're looking for. Now, what we actually like to have is that specific patterns occur all over the place. However, they don't. In this get method over here, the property lock precedes unlock
does not occur. And this makes it a violation.
And this violation can be found formally again by coming up with the intersection of two such formal concepts and looking for the missing element. This is how we detect that get over here has an anomaly. It does not, here lock, proceed, unlock, does not go.
We implemented this whole thing and made it run on aspect J.
Yep, sure.
So in the when you say that the lock unlock property does not occur, does it mean that it doesn't even use locks? Or it
It uses lock, but it uses lock? Because otherwise lock, sure. No, it doesn't have anything to do with locks, so it's an anomaly. No. It uses locks, but this property doesn't hold. Okay. Actually, this was the very same question I had just now. So we looked at we implemented OPMine and made it run on aspect J. Aspect J has about 3,000 classes and roughly 36,000 methods. These are the methods you'd have to come up with a manual specification in order to
to describe how these methods are typically used.
Out of these 36,000 methods, there's 1,154 methods that are being used more than 20 times, and also that do have operational preconditions. Not every method does have an operational precondition. For instance, if we're talking about a constructor without any arguments, you can always call that one. And within these 1,154 violations, OPMine found precisely 300. It's bad, should have been 301 or 299. Did you know that? I think that the first measurement of Mount Everest was 8,800 meters. And they added one extra meter just to make it look like a true measurement. that's right. So in that sense, I should probably come up with 301 violations in here. it took out 8 minutes to find all these violations on a standard laptop like mine, for instance. This is in sharp contrast to other times. I've heard about tools who take a month to produce a similar number of violations. And we checked every single one of these 300 violations. This was the hard work, the hardest work of all. So we checked every single of these 300 violations, whether these violations would actually be true bugs or not. So here's a couple of things we found in aspect G. To start with, a true defect. This is the defect I showed initially. This is iter. This should be iter 2. And this defect is exactly after finding this defect, we actually went and created the appropriate input that would trigger this defect. And this is how we eventually managed aspect J to crash. So this bug was not known before we actually did this work.
So what's the relationship between the violation, finding that, and finding the defect? Is that manual?
I have a list of violations. And then you need to, then as a programmer, you check whether the violation is indeed a true defect, as in this case, or a false positive, as I will show in 2 seconds. So, 5 minutes. Okay, thank you.
If you do have a question.
Yeah. Okay. Here's another defect, just to have fun. Where was that expert from?
Steve,
sorry. Yeah. Oh, I thought you were Steve, sorry. No, of course, Steve, there you go. Here's another defect in here. Can you spot it?
Is it the coarse in the string?
The coarse in the string. Yeah. It's a coarse in the string in here. Yeah, exactly. It's a single quote where we should actually have double quotes in here. Yeah. What happens in here is that there's a constraint being violated, and it actually should give you the name of the constraint being violated. Instead, what it does, it issues plus T plus instead of the true constraint happening. And that's because all calls to constraint violated typically use an argument that's constructed from multiple strings where one of these elements is indeed a type code. This is the normal usage of this method, constraint violated. In here, there's just a constant string being passed, so this is a violation of the operational precondition, a violation which turns out to be a true defect in here. R is a false positive. This is a method where R OP minor reports a violation. It's abnormal usage, but there's no bug in there. The thing is that we're passing a string in here, which comes from an array of identifiers. This is non-normal usage, because in 48 out of 51 cases, the argument actually comes from a string constructor rather than from an array of identifiers. This is what you get. This is abnormal, but this is not a defect. Just creative. And here's one of my favorites. This is also a bug. Oh, yeah. Again, chance for you. Pete Steven. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that piece of code?
Attention policy is not initialized?
No.
Is it next instead of next?
No.
Are you missing return?
Return. The return is that. The return in here is an unconditional return. It's an unconditional return in a loop. And which means that this loop actually does not loop. Or, another way, this piece of code is actually executed either zero times or one time, which we in computer science normally call a condition, not a loop. Okay. But what we have in here is an iterator, which is an iterator over a collection of so-called retention policies. And this whole thing only works because in the current version of AspectJ, there's at most one retention policy that's actually been implemented in here, which means that it works for now, but this, of course, is something that can be highly confusing in the long term. Well, it's already confusing as it stands right now, but this is also a time bomb waiting to blow into your face as soon as you come up with another assumption that there's more than one retention policy in here. Overall, in AspectJ, we found a total of 16 defects, all of these reported and verified by the developers. Most of them already fixed too, because they were too difficult to fix. We found 42 code smells. We're still discussing with the developers whether this should be fixed or not. But there was also a large amount of false positives. All in all, there's about 5 false positives to 1 true problem in the code. Since it took us about 2.5 minutes to check each of these, this means that every 12 minutes we found a new problem in AspectJ while going through all these violations. Besides AspectJ, we also looked at a larger number of programs where we didn't always investigate all the bugs. It takes some time to become an expert in deciding whether something's a true bug or not. And if it took us 2.5 minutes per violation, we assume that the AspectJ programmers would be much, much faster than we would be. Overall, in all these programs, we found that 1 out of 4 violations being reported was a true problem. Many of these problems being very subtle. Look at you. It took you some time to find out why this is a problem, to spot them. And we're not aware of that many other tools that are able to detect these violations automatically. Stuff we're working on right now is procedural languages. So far, this is a Java approach. And since this works on arguments, procedural languages may actually be an even more interesting field of study. We're looking for inter-procedural analysis. Right now, this is intra-procedural, because we're looking at the usage within the method, and we look at violations within a method. We're not trying to be deep in here. And we're currently investigating on whether going deep helps us, but there's also risks involved with that. We're looking at ranking violations in order to identify the true bugs earlier on. And we're looking at early programmer support that is making recommendations while you work. Okay, and with that, I'd like to close. This is OP minor, which learns such operational preconditions from existing code, learns from normal usage. It's fully automatic. And we found dozens of true and verified defects. Thank you for attention. Andy.
Andreas, what does this say about, or what can you tell us about why these bugs are still in these products after all this time?
Yeah, this was, see, we found dozens of verified defects in production code. That is code that is around for a long time. That's not code that's in beta stage or something. And all of these defects, so verified defects meant we actually were able to produce test cases that violated them. We found that so many of these bugs are really subtle. So you look at the code and it takes you, and you don't spot them at once. It's not your typical type of pattern, because these are violations that span a number of locations, which makes them makes it easier to spot them. Second thing is also in the case of Aspect J, the test suite covers only 40% of the statements in Aspect J, which means that some of the code we showed in here was never ever tested. And third thing is, it's actually, and this is something we found when trying to reproduce these defects, you need to come up with a fairly sophisticated test case that covers first this spot, and then this other spot. And this is precisely why I think that this type of bug simply is not spotted, neither by the test case nor by reviews, but still they are in the production.
Do you think they're turning up in the field, or are the conditions so unusual that they're just not causing failures out in the field?
Well, for the code smells, we are sure that they didn't show up in the field because for the code smells, we haven't been able to trigger them. Just look at the code. For the true failures, I can't report on that. But all of the defects we found in Aspect J, for instance, were immediately considered by the developers and fixed in the next release.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So when you find an error report, how easy or how difficult is it to debug such an error report like this for a multi-threaded program? And do you find cases where these errors happen because of weird interactions between threads?
We haven't looked at multi-threaded programs yet, but because the control flow becomes so much more complicated. But this would be a very interesting future research, finding out if you consider multiple interactions between threads and multiple orderings, looking for anomalies in there. Yes, would be very interesting.
What is the minimum size corpus of code you need to start deriving some patterns and then having confidence that you have outliers?
Yeah. What we have in here, what we used in here, was a minimum support of 20. That is, we need 20 usages in order to learn from. This is another alternative to that approach would be to use type state. That is, to look at usages of individual types and how type progresses over time. But we're looking at individual arguments and individual methods, which means that from the very start we have a far smaller number to learn from. And this is a challenge also in terms of false positives. But one of the initial work we're looking into is rankings and coming up with ways to work even with a small number of instances as we're having them in this setting.
Does it make sense to analyze a lot of different programs written in the same language and
until
that, conglomerated information?
Yes, sure. As soon as you have programs that all have a common usage pattern of some library, for instance, think about the C or Java runtime libraries, then of course you have plenty of instances to learn from. Think Google code, for instance, large bodies of code all working with this, all interacting with the same APIs. This is the perfect playground in order to find anomalies.
We're going to have to stop now. Thank you very much.